X-Talks connects professionals in the life science, medical device, and food industries with useful content like webinars, job openings, articles, and virtual meetings to help you succeed in your career. This Food Industry Focus podcast brings together some of our editorial staff to share insights into the latest B2B industry news to help keep you up to date. This week on the show, we're discussing the company New Culture and their animal-free mozzarella, and Dunkin' Spiked, the donuts brand's latest foray into alcohol. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the X-Talks Food Podcast. I'm Sydney Perlmutter, Senior Food Industry Journalist and Webinar Moderator at xtalks.com, and this week I'm joined by Vera Kovacevic and Sarah Hand. Thanks for coming today. So I'm going to start off with a story about a new product that definitely caught my eye and that you don't really hear of that much in terms of the combination of these two things. So Dunkin', which many of our listeners have certainly heard of, even probably our Canadian ones, it's America's largest coffee and donut chain. They recently announced the launch of Dunkin' Spiked Iced Coffees and Iced Teas. So these are two new boozy beverages, and they're set to roll out in early September. They'll feature four iced coffees and four iced teas based on the chain's pre-existing flavors. So initial spiked coffee flavors include original, caramel, mocha, and vanilla, each with 6% alcohol by volume or ABV. Dunkin' Spiked Teas have an ABV of 5% and will be available in slightly sweet, half and half, strawberry dragon fruit, and mango pineapple. And these malt-based ready-to-drink beverages follow several seasonal beer collaborations with Harpoon Brewery. So in a press release, Brian Gilbert, the Vice President of Retail Business Development at Dunkin', said, "We know we had the opportunity to create something special when we saw the positive response to our previous seasonal collaborations for Dunkin'-inspired beers. The growing appetite for adult beverages inspired us to put a twist on our customers' favorite Dunkin' iced coffees, iced tea, and refresher flavors." So Dunkin' is entering quite a crowded market segment with the launch of the Dunkin' Spiked series, but that's a reflection of the rising popularity of ready-to-drink drinks that offer innovative blends of well-loved tastes. And as this trend gains momentum, the market for ready-to-drink alcoholic beverages is set to rise significantly. So from a market research and consulting firm called Insight Ace Analytic, the global RTD alcohol market was estimated to be valued at $36.42 billion last year and is expected to experience a compound annual growth rate of 11.2% between last year and 2030. And this market encompasses not only alcoholic coffees and teas, but also cocktails, kombuchas, seltzers, sakes, wine coolers, and more. So despite this fierce competition, the Dunkin' brand has the potential, though, to carve out a distinct identity in this dynamic landscape. And like many other popular non-alcoholic beverage brands, Dunkin' is hoping to capitalize on its loyal customer base as it makes its first foray into the RTD alcoholic market. Or not its first, but its first of its own brand, I should say. And while there isn't really a dominant leader in the spiked coffee market, the hard tea market is currently dominated by Twisted Tea, which is brewed by the Boston Beer Company. Remarkably, Twisted Tea is now the beer company's largest brand, surpassing Truly and Samuel Adams Beer, which have seen their popularities fade. And while it remains to be seen whether Dunkin' can rival Twisted Tea, this market is certainly ready for new players. And on the other hand, Dunkin' could face a tougher road ahead when it comes to their hard coffees, which, like I say, kind of lacks the same level of popularity as other alcoholic RTD beverages. There's only currently a handful of brands that occupy this space, including Kahlua's Espresso Martinis and Loverboy, which is a canned cocktail from some of Bravo's Summer House stars. And even more prominent players in this category have faced setbacks. Just last year, Pabst Blue Ribbon, or PBR, decided to discontinue its hard coffee flavor due to lackluster sales. And similarly, in 2019, a partnership between Molson Coors and La Colombe to introduce hard cold brew coffee failed to resonate with consumers, leading to its discontinuation within a year of its launch. So in terms of the details of this new series of beverages, the spiked iced coffees contain about 30 milligrams of caffeine, less than the average 100 milligrams of caffeine found in a cup of coffee. And drinkers can buy a variety pack consisting of a dozen 12-ounce cans, three of all four flavors, and the original flavor will also be sold in a 4-pack of 12-ounce cans or single cans as well. And the spiked iced teas also contain caffeine, a little less, ranging from 15 to also 30, depending on the flavor, and come in a similar set of drinks. And while the pricing details remain unreleased for the time being, Dunkin' Spiked will not be available for purchase at Dunkin' locations due to alcohol laws. But upon their debut, consumers will be able to find them in a dozen U.S. states, including Florida, Massachusetts, New York, and Texas. And they've released a feature on their website to help people locate, where outlets carry the products. So, when I was writing this, I was thinking of, what were some of the other like non-alcoholic brands that tried to get into alcohol? And I thought of the Jack and Coke. So the that collaboration that we talked about quite a while ago now on the podcast, I thought about that. But, I was really thinking about sort of this spiked coffee space and how like you really don't see too much of that. And I'm just wondering, given the success and just the name that Dunkin' has made for itself in the coffee space, do you think that it sort of already has that like built-in consumer base that like could give this a try? Or do you think they should kind of just stick to their, coffee and donuts that they do so well?
Yeah, I guess if you already like Dunkin's coffee and you're somewhere where you can buy beer and liquor and you see that and you like, the iced coffee, maybe that's something you give it a try. While you were presenting this story, Sydney, I was trying to think of who is the market? Like, is this the same person that prefers like a cooler over a beer, something like a sweeter alcoholic beverage? And I was also wondering what is the alcohol that's in it then? Is it just like a coffee liqueur?
So they called it like a malt-based beverage.
Ah, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess whatever malt is. I was thinking that too, like how, cuz I think in the past like why we don't see as many of these like hard coffees is that it's a little bit harder to incorporate like traditional alcohol into coffee without the flavors just not, they probably wouldn't work well together. So I think they probably took a lot of time to sort of develop the right alcohol and percentage and like flavors, to make this work. I'd imagine it was slightly easier with the tea. I'm not sure if those were malt based as well. But I was reading, I think in the press release as well, there was another quote that was like, people can now start their day with Dunkin' and end their day with Dunkin' as well. So I guess that's who they're targeting here, because it's kind of an odd thing to drink. Coffee is traditionally drank in the morning and throughout the day to give you like an energy boost, but I don't know how many people are wanting to drink it sort of at dinner time or later than that, when it's normal to consume alcohol. So,
and maybe that's why they decided to keep the caffeine content lower-ish, right? Because they're not expecting people to like crack one in the morning kind of thing. So that's probably part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've never heard of like what hard tea or hard coffee is. I just thought it was like super concentrated coffee, kind of like a cold brew. So I was very surprised to hear that it has alcohol in it. So that was so interesting. And yes, Sydney, I was wondering the exact same thing, because most people drink coffee in the morning or the afternoon, and then, they have a drink with dinner or the evening. So I don't know. I think it's a very unique beverage with like a very niche, market. So I hope they do well, but I just can't see them doing as well as they would with their, non-alcoholic beverages they sell donuts too, right?
They're basically an American like Tim Hortons. That's the only thing I can compare them to that we know here in Canada. I think it's like, I noted this, but I think it's like important to note that like this is, even though it's Dunkin' brand, you can't get them at the retail stores because their laws. And I think like Dunkin' is really relying on like their customer base to recognize the name when they see it at like a liquor store and just be willing to give it a try. And you know, I love Dunkin'. Whenever I'm in the States, I'll get a coffee because they're, to me, they're also kind of, you know, low in terms of like actual caffeine, I think, and just more like cream and sugar. And I love that. Who doesn't love that? And if I actually may enjoy these drinks if I ever get a hand on them. But yeah, I think they have honestly carved out quite a space for themselves in this market. And I think they could do well. And with the teas, I'm not too sure because, yeah, like I said, Twisted Tea has like quite a stronghold on the market right now.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The teas make, like at first when you were presenting this, I thought the teas seem like less of a leap to me. But then mm-hmm. when you look at it, you think, you know, Irish coffee is a thing, like people putting like Kahlua or mm-hmm. Bailey's or something in their coffee. I guess I just associate that more with a hot beverage than a cold beverage. But obviously iced coffee is huge and people love their iced coffee. So maybe this does make a lot of sense. Like maybe this is something that someone would have, you know, in the afternoon mm-hmm. Instead of a beer or something like that. But yeah, it doesn't feel like, it feels very different from, I picture like an Irish coffee, like having that after a nice, you know, dinner or whatever. Mm-hmm. This feels less like that because it's iced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I could see myself really, like I said, enjoying this, but getting very like carried away because I'm sure they have so much sugar in them as well.
Right. Yeah.
And it, you know, it probably wouldn't be great for, you know, the following day. But I think that, you know, in moderation, it would be an excellent beverage. And yeah, kind of like whenever, you know, when people make their own drinks, like alcoholic or otherwise, or alcoholic drinks, you're not really making, yeah, an iced coffee and adding like, you know, alcohol to it. That's just not really. So not to say that Dunkin' like is literally inventing something new, but mm-hmm. I think they're trying to start something. They're trying to start something. And I wonder if like other coffee brands or retailers will try the same thing in the future. I can't really see Starbucks doing something like this though. I don't know if you guys disagree with me on that, but it doesn't really seem like something Starbucks would do.
I don't know, because I think about how you can get the Starbucks, like, what is it? It's like a Frappuccino, but it's in like a bottle or something.
Oh,
like
I love
get that
those.
At
yes.
So
yes.
I don't know. That feels like not as much of a leap, but mm-hmm. I think the leap that would be there is like, yeah, do they want to get into the alcohol space?
Yeah.
And it is like, even though it's staying within beverage, like I think we all know that's two very different, you know, beverage categories, coffee mm-hmm. and then like alcoholic coffee. Mm-hmm. And so I think maybe it's a risk. Like, yeah, I wonder kind of like what they're going for, Dunkin', with this. I think you're right, Sydney. I think they're banking on, you know, the brand recognition for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think that's also interesting what you said about the brewery that makes Sam Adams beer, and now the Twisted Tea has like the sales have surpassed that, which seems wild because I mm-hmm. think like Sam Adams is such a recognizable. A recognizable brand name. So,
you know what else I was wondering? Like, is there a hard coffee section in the liquor store here in Ontario, Canada? Because I know there's like a cider section, and I'm just like wondering where would this drink be found in a liquor
that's
store?
That's a great question. That's a really good question. I can like from what I would guess, probably next to like the hard teas that already exist, like there, to my knowledge, we don't already have like a section with hard coffees because it's not really a commonly consumed like ready to drink beverage. Yeah. So yeah, that's a really good question. Maybe they'd put it next to like the coffee liqueurs, but I think they have to be refrigerated, so they'd still have to be you know in like you know in a fridge, and I don't think the liqueurs have to be. So yeah, that's they may have their own sort of section, and that's going to be for customers to discover.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
near the pre-mixed drinks too, like well things like. Next to coolers or like the ready to drink mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. like the Jack and Coke or the, mm-hmm. the premix like Caesars or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, I picture it being kind of there. But I also thought I wonder if you'd find it next to coffee liqueurs, but the difference in alcohol volume there, that I feel like that would mm-hmm. be like putting a Jack and Coke next to Jack Daniels.
Jack,
like,
yeah.
Jack Daniels, and like that's quite, those are two different things for sure. So, yeah, and then the refrigeration aspect here too, but I guess it's not so much of a leap. I don't know. There's been like hard lemonade for a while mm-hmm. too. I don't know how popular that is anymore, but people really got on board with that for a while. So
mm-hmm. yeah, I think like every, you know, once a new generation sort of becomes of legal drinking age, they sort of, you know, have a big influence on what the market is going to be like for not only like, you know, like seltzers and beverages of this kind, but I think just in general, like the beverage industry, I think they have a huge impact. And I think with like, you know, social media and everything, I think that impact is like even bigger. And I know that like younger cohorts like really like Dunkin'. So I wonder mm-hmm. like, you know, if they'll be sort of a targeted consumer, obviously of legal drinking age, of course. But yeah, mm-hmm. I think it speaks to sort of the trendiness and the coming and going of various like different drinks that you can incorporate alcohol into, because yeah, lemonade like used to be a huge thing when like I was in university. Now not really seeing it as much. Yeah. And I think it also like it definitely has to do with like what others around you are drinking. Like if you're drinking like a Sam Adams and you're with people who are drinking Twisted Teas, they're gonna look at you and be like, why are you still drinking that? Like Twisted Teas are the new thing, you know. I think like peer influence is like really big when it comes to this stuff as well. So we'll see how big of an impact like people will have on this product and see how big it can become. All right, so moving on to our next story. So I found a company called New Culture, and it's one of several emerging startups that's using precision fermentation to produce casein proteins. And it has scaled up its fermentation process to increase manufacturing volumes, specifically for its animal-free mozzarella. And the company is confident that it can scale up while maintaining price parity with traditional mozzarella within the next 3 years. So this company is based in San Leandro, California, and it works with an external partner to produce fermentation batches of casein, which is a protein found in milk. And it brings out the sort of the white color that we know of and what makes cheese stretchy as well. So the batches yield mozzarella that has the familiar qualities of conventional cheese, like melting, stretching, and bubbling for about 25,000 pizzas per year. So the company's ultimate goal is to scale up production in order to produce enough cheese for 14 million pizzas annually within the same 3-year time frame. In a press release, the company's co-founder and CSO said, "Our world-class team at New Culture has solved a string of incredibly complex technical challenges in order to produce our animal-free casein at this scale. We are redefining the boundaries of what's possible in dairy in a way that isn't being done anywhere else." So this company is relatively new. It was founded in 2019 and, like I said, produces animal-free mozzarella through a unique blend of traditional cheese-making techniques and casein proteins cultivated via precision fermentation. The company debuted its animal-free mozzarella at Nancy Silverton's Pizzeria Mozza in LA in June of this year. The official launch of New Culture's mozzarella is set for 2024 at the same location, with plans for expansion to various pizzerias across the country. So to my knowledge, I believe this is, you know, a B2B company rather than B2C. So crossing this production milestone marks a significant step in introducing a dairy-free alternative to traditional mozzarella for pizzerias across the U.S. According to the startup, this achievement stands as the world's first case of producing animal-free casein at such a considerable scale. Not to mention, following this breakthrough in production capability, New Culture says it achieved an 80% reduction in product costs. New Culture has received financial backing from notable food companies, including Kraft Heinz, ADM, and biotech powerhouse CJ Chiljadong, I believe. excuse my pronunciation. These investments totaling $28.5 million over 7 rounds of funding have helped advance the company's innovative platform, which is capable of producing any type of cheese without relying on animal-based dairy. And as New Culture continues to advance its production capabilities, it is laying the foundation for a relatively new sector that has substantial implications for animal welfare, environmental sustainability, and human health. And advocates of precision fermentation argue that creating real dairy proteins without relying on cows is a win-win scenario because you get the nutritional and functional benefits of dairy without the ethical and environmental concerns associated with large-scale animal farming. The conventional approach to these to cheese production involves substantial consumption of water and energy resources, as well as possible mistreatment of animals. And in contrast, New Culture's animal-free mozzarella demands only a fraction of these resources thanks to precision fermentation. And this groundbreaking process not only eliminates the necessity for animal-based ingredients, but also allows consumers to enjoy the mozzarella that they already know and love. So we've talked about precision fermentation before, and sort of the more that I'm talking about lab-grown meat, I think that precision fermentation and like cultured dairy is becoming just as big as well. But I think we talked about how there's a little bit less of like that psychological maybe block when it comes to dairy as opposed to meat, especially because I think that, you know, if you look at the picture in this this story and you see the mozzarella that's melted on pizza, you would have absolutely zero idea that it isn't just normal mozzarella, right? Dairy-based mozzarella looks exactly like the same thing. So do you think that, you know, in terms of how things look, if it looks exactly like the mozzarella you're used to, that, you know, you'd have an easier time sort of transitioning to something like this if you were trying to get away from dairy?
I think definitely. Yeah, go ahead, Vera.
Yeah, I was just gonna say certainly. I think when people buy pizza, they tend to buy it for the visual appeal too. Like they like they select the toppings and they you know, people are very picky with what kind of pizza they want sometimes. So yeah, I think visual appeal on a pizza is amazing because it is like fast food. So something you want to look visually appealing.
Yeah. And I think that because it's, as you said, more of a like restaurant supply kind of thing right now, this company isn't looking into, you know, selling the mozzarella in grocery stores to consumers or even direct to consumer. I think that the biggest thing from a restaurant perspective is, you know, price. And they said they're going to offer it, you know, as close as possible to on par, right, with traditional you know, milk-based, well, I shouldn't even say this is also milk-based, but like animal-derived mozzarella cheese, I guess. I think that's the biggest thing. And then as long as it's performing the same way and tasting the same way, I think this is like a no-brainer to change to. Mm-hmm. I was thinking too, like, I'm wondering because they're not able to completely switch to this type of mozzarella, like specifically at this pizza place in LA, I'm wondering, you know, how they debuted it there, if they said, listen, for this amount of time we're just using this type of mozzarella, you know, made through fermentation, or if they gave people the option to have one or the other, like if someone had an ethical objection to the way cheese is normally produced, but still like to eat cheese, let's say they didn't want to be, you know, vegan or whatever, if they had the option for this cheese. But I think this is like totally a no-brainer, and I think that like when companies are able to figure out this technology and produce something outside of having to rely on animals, it just makes the most sense to me. This is still cheese. You know, it's not like a cheese substitute made of something else to look and feel like cheese. It's still cheese. I think there's potentially more hurdles to overcome, like they were saying, in terms of like the texture and how it behaves. But probably a lot more payoff in the end in terms of people being accepting and willing to try it and maybe willing to switch to it.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that as sort of my second question, like, you know, what duty do they have, or do restaurants have, or I guess even Now, I guess at this point, just restaurants, like, what duty do they have, if any, to sort of let consumers know that, like, what this is? Because it seems like, to me, I wouldn't be, you know, if I took a bite of this pizza and I didn't know, I wouldn't be like, oh my God, like, I need to regurgitate this. Like, it wouldn't be like a shock to me. I think with meat, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think about, like, how restaurants, or like just this one in particular, like how they, if they did switch from traditional mozzarella to this, what should they have to do to let consumers know what they're about to eat, if they have to do anything?
Wouldn't the FDA regulate that? Like, you know, wouldn't they give some kind of advice about what to do there? Because, you know, the FDA usually says, like, how they should market a product to consumers or what they should write, right? Like, if it's free of trans fats, for example, like that. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, sometimes the FDA steps in and says, like, this is what you need to write on your product.
Yeah.
Or this is what you need to inform people if it's this or that.
Right. And then just like, you know, and how does one do that, like, in a restaurant setting, mm-hmm. right? Just, it's because, you know, you can put anything on a package, and then, you know, from there, mm-hmm. once it's purchased, it's in the consumer's hands to, like, look it up or whatever they want to do. But with a restaurant, it's a little, yeah, Vera, what do you think?
Usually, like, when you go to these, like, more high-end pizza places, right, pizza uh-huh. restaurants, for each, like, pizza that you select, they have all the ingredients for that selection, right? So they'll tell mm-hmm. you anything from down to, like, the herbs they put on it, right? So it has a list of ingredients. So I imagine that they could just write animal-free mozzarella.
Mm, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, probably.
And then that could just be one ingredient on the mm-hmm. pizza. So if it does taste slightly less, the restaurant can always say, well, it's there. It's on the menu.
It's not on me. We told you.
Yeah. We told you. Yeah, I think, yeah, all these pizzerias, they usually have the list of
No, you're right. You're right. Like, and even, and sometimes as specific as, like, what type of mozzarella it is,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Or,
yeah.
And even, like, the bread. Do you want, like, mm-hmm. thin crust? Do you want gluten-free? Like, there's, mm-hmm. they just, there's so many options. These, mm-hmm. like, specialized pizza restaurants that I imagine mm-hmm. would probably be on the menu.
I can see in some instances, like, I'm going to take a wild guess and say that at a fancy pizza place in LA, probably they're playing up the aspect that this is, like, cruelty-free mozzarella. Mm-hmm. It is still real
You're
cheese.
You're definitely right, yeah.
However, some other parts of the country or the world that are maybe less accepting of food tech, or just maybe don't have the same sort of, you know, ethical or whatever objections to regular mozzarella, you know, from cow's milk, from a cow, I'm not sure that they would want to play that up. And I'm not sure that they would, or that they would be compelled to by any regulator. Like, when you, I know what you're saying, Vera, like, on a menu, you've got everything listed. I can 100% see in this situation, they're like, oh, we have this very special mozzarella. You know, no cows were harmed in the making of this mozzarella kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
But when you think about it, like, restaurants are only going to play up the things that they think are going to be valuable to them or look good on them. And so maybe you see a menu where it says, you know, we've got, like, vegan gravy, or this is non-GMO greens or whatever, but you're never gonna see, like, all the greens we use are, like, super GMO. Like, they're never gonna play up anything that they think their customer yeah. base is, like, not gonna like the look of. So I don't know. I think when you say precision fermentation technology, like, I get the sense that we all feel, like, pretty okay with that, and we also talk about all of this stuff for a living. But I think that there would be some people that would be like, hold on, what is this? Is it mm-hmm. cheese? You know what I mean? Maybe yeah. maybe even the same people that wouldn't want to have any sort of cheese alternative either. That wouldn't even feel comfortable with something like, I don't know, like a soy-based cheese or something, because they just want normal cheese. They just want to know where it came from. So I think that's a good question. I think that's something that we talked about in a previous episode. It was, like, something to do with a new Like, yeah, it was like lettuce
Italy
or something.
Banned lab grown meat.
Oh, there was that too. Yeah, there was that too. So I really think like this seems great to me. I can see some people worrying about, well, how is this produced? And like, is it safe to eat? And picturing like a weird lab environment and like, is this even food? You know what I mean? So I don't know. I can't even remember really like where I was going with that point, only to say that I just like wonder what's the cap for uptake for something like this? And and how much does it depend on like where you're trying to roll this out, really? You know?
Yeah, I was just gonna say that like it makes so much sense that this was debuted in California, right? Yeah. And that this company is based in California because like they're an audience typically that like, you know, understands and is very accepting of food tech and just anything more like ethical and sustainable. So that completely makes sense. And I think like there will be a leap, you know, with sort of educating consumers who may not be as just like as familiar with precision fermentation, just because like traditional like plant-based cheese, at least in my opinion, not that great. So I think that like since this, you know, should taste like traditional mozzarella, that like maybe there'll just be some confusion over maybe people may still think it is like a plant-based cheese, like they'll and they'll just think like, oh whoa, it got so good in the last like few years. And it probably has. It probably has gotten better since I've last tried it, but it's gonna be like since it's such like an emerging like sector, I actually am not too sure how involved at the moment like the FDA is in terms of like regulating these types of products. Obviously they are allowed and they've been approved, but I'm not too sure how like, you know, how they are able to market themselves. So at this point I kind of feel like it's a little bit of like a free-for-all and they're just doing their best and launching where they know that people will sort of understand, and then hopefully, you know, there'll be more rollouts elsewhere. But I agree, Sarah. I mean, I think this is an excellent like product and with that should not be terribly controversial. It just requires like a little bit of just like understanding, and for someone to just like make all that science and tech just sound like just you know, be understandable to the average person, because I'm not, you know, I don't have a science background, but when things are explained to you like pretty simply, It all kind of makes sense. It makes sense. And then we also have to think about like how much regular food goes through like processing and manufacturing as well. Like this type of precision fermentation is like far from the only type of, you know, food tech that goes on within the, you know, within like what we eat kind of on a daily basis, you know? So it's just sort of like it's disrupting the market a little bit. And maybe the disrupt, you know, it'll calm down eventually when people are more accepting. And of course the taste is obviously always the most important thing too. As long as it tastes as it says it's going to and like traditional mozzarella, then there should really be no problem with it.
Yeah. And I think that, if this takes off, we're bound to see some pushback from, you know, milk producers, as we've seen with a lot of the plant-based milks. And like, I wonder if this were to ever go into a grocery store and sit alongside traditionally made cheese, you know, would they say, I don't think you're allowed to call this cheese because you didn't get the milk from a cow, even though, you know, it has the casein? Like, what would you even call this? Like, you wouldn't call plant-based cheese. It's not plant-based. You know what I mean? It's still like an animal protein. I just like, I'm sure that's, you know, years out, or maybe it's not, I don't know. But I just think that it's, yeah, it's a leap. It's a leap, as we've been saying. Yeah.
And then there's the whole question, and I'll wrap it up after this, but there's the whole question of whether it's, you know, whether it can be considered vegan, right? Because it's still got that milk protein in it, but it's not coming from animals. So that's kind of, I think that's more up to like individuals to decide. Yeah, like notable companies that use precision fermentation in dairy are like Perfect Day, which makes ice cream, and there's like Knott Co., which makes Knott milk,
right?
As well. So we've talked about this in the past, but like I think the more time goes on and the more like, you know, the more just regulatory questions we start having, just because like it's really complex, even though it shouldn't be. But yeah, I'll definitely keep an eye out on, you know, anything from like the FDA or any other agencies, just because, yeah, we've got too many questions and we can't answer them all here. We're just speculating. But yeah, appreciate your guys' input and questions. They've been awesome. So that's the end of this episode of the X Talks Food Podcast. If you liked today's show, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Thanks, everyone, and see you next week. Bye.
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 Thanks for listening to the X Talks Food Industry Podcast. If you enjoyed our discussions today, please share the episode with your friends and colleagues, and be sure to subscribe in order to be notified when a new episode is released. To join in on the discussion, you can find X Talks on social media, email podcast@xtalks.com, or comment on the articles directly. Links are in the show description. Take a moment to join our community at xtalks.com to get access to everything we have to offer, including webinars, job listings, virtual meetings, articles, and more. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast are those of the speakers sharing them. They should not be taken as professional advice and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position Honeycomb Worldwide. For further information, email us at podcast@xtalks.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.